You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
He looks determined without being ruthless. Something heroic in his manner. There's a courage about him. Doesn't look like a killer. Comes across so calm. Acts like he has a dream. Full of passion.
You don't trust me, huh?
Well, you know why.
I do. We're not supposed to trust anyone in our profession anyway.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Rematch, which is part of the BasketballNews.com podcast network. On The Rematch, you'll hear in-depth interviews with notable names from all walks of life. Because sometimes the media just doesn't get it right. The Rematch is that second opportunity to clarify, put things in proper context, correct fake news or misreported controversy. The media still exists as the most powerful entity on earth because they control the minds of the masses. I'm Matan Thomas. And the full truth is what we are aiming to catch. Many media stories omit details that would dilute their clickbait roar. And that's why there's a need for The Rematch. Today I sat down with former NBA player and co-host of All the Smoke, Matt Barnes. We talked about his activism after the murder of Stephon Clark in his hometown of Sacramento, his aspirations to run for mayor, his coalition along with Van Jones, Charmelaine, and Robert Swift aimed at holding President Biden accountable moving forward, and him taking the very high road and making amends with his former teammate Derek Fisher because it was best for his family. This was a great interview. Hope you enjoy.
All right, Matt Barnes, how you doing, sir?
I'm good. Yourself? How about yourself, buddy?
Man, I'm blessed. I can't complain, man. I can't complain. Listen, I love what y'all are doing, you and Stack. You know what I mean? I love the fact that y'all have gone into this area of media, and it was, I mean, if I'm saying like it was for me, I didn't really like the media when I was playing. You know what I mean? And I feel kind of similar with y'all, but y'all are doing it differently to give guys an opportunity. I love what y'all are doing.
No, I appreciate it. You know, as athletes, we always thought there was some sort of motive. There was a handful of people that you kind of trusted, but for the most part, you really had to watch yourself with the media. And that's something Jack and I are trying to change. Obviously, experiencing pretty much everything that our guests have experienced gives us a little easier intro and a different approach, which allows, you know, most of our guests to really let their wall down and feel comfortable speaking to us.
Right. That's what's up, man. I mean, and it's been great. It's a great product. And, you know, I want to talk to you about a lot. So I appreciate you coming on The Rematch, basketballnews.com, Fly TV. And I'm going to use a portion of this for my book, like I was telling you. And so what I want to talk about is not really a whole lot with basketball. It's with other stuff. You know what I mean? I mean,
I'm good.
So you've been doing a lot with using your voice and your platform. Yeah. In particular, after Stephon Clark's murder. And so now you didn't know him personally, but it was it hit home for you because it was in your hometown of Sacramento.
Right.
So first, let's remind everybody about exactly what happened with the case.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there was some calls that someone was breaking into cars, and, you know, Stephon happened to be out. They chased him down into his grandmother's backyard. and shot him several times. I'm not exactly, I think it was six to eight shots in his back, but I don't know how many rounds they let go. And, you know, like 99% of the cases in the United States, the cops were, you know, not held responsible for the situation. I had happened to just be watching CNN that morning in my room with my twins, and they heard Sacramento. So I was watching it. They were playing on their iPads. They heard Sacramento. So they started paying attention. They're like, "Dad, did you know him?" I'm like, "No, I didn't know him." And they're like, "Man, you think, you know," and they were kind of just confused, and kind of their confusion and hurt is what really made me kind of want to be like, "Okay, well, let me see if there's something I can do to kind of, you know, show my kids that, you know, that there's ways to help in situations like this." So, you know, myself, Marcus Cousins, I think the Sacramento Kings helped a little bit, a handful of people helped. And, you know, we just made the crossover experience a little easier for the family, you know, by helping with the funerals and getting people situated in hotels and really kind of doing everything we possibly can to, like I said, trying to ease as much pain as possible from the family. But me continuing to use my platform and calling out the DA out there, Anne Marie Schubert. She's a very crooked DA, takes money from the police department all the time, and then, you know, has never really dropped the hammer on any situation out there, which is very unfortunate. But I think, you know, me with the platform I have and the voice I have to be able to call stuff like that out and to allow other people to see it and the other people to start calling it. And hopefully this will be her last term as DA, because now everyone's really awake about voting and how important voting is. And hopefully we'll be able to get her out after this this last term she's serving right now.
Talk about how it personally affected you. Like, so I know for myself, you know, anytime a tragedy like this happens, I immediately start talking to my kids and talking to them about it, and they start asking questions. You mentioned your sons saw it because they're from Sacramento, so that's where you're from, so that's probably what caught there. So I remember when Trayvon Martin happened, and my son Malcolm, he was like 6 at the time, and, you know, he was asking me questions about it and everything, and, you know, my son is tall for his age, you know what I mean? Right. He was 6, but he was tall. I mean, I'm 6'10", my wife's 6 feet, you know. So I knew that in a while, he's not going to look like a little kid. You know, they're going to treat him like he's a teenager or something like that. So there was, I had to start talking to him about the rules and how he had to do this, like having the talk that, you know what I mean, Black people have to have with our kids whenever something like this happens. Did you have those kind of discussions with your sons?
I did. And it's crazy because, like you said, it's the talk that African-Americans have to have with their kids. You know, this is not a common talk that, you know, that every parent has to go through, you know, like, you know, the old sex talk or that. Like, this is really targeted at Black and brown people having to educate their kids at a very young age. You know, the situation with I briefly talked to them about it because it was so fresh and so new. But then the George Floyd situation came up, you know, this past summer, and they're 12 now and obviously more awake, and they're on, you know, a few social media outlets. And I remember I picked, it was my ex-wife's week, but we had practice. So I picked them up that Saturday right after it happened. And I asked if they'd seen what happened. And one of my sons like, "Yeah, another cop killed a Black man." Right. I'm just like, man, you know, like 12, and they're kind of already picking up on what it is. And we kind of just started talking back and forth about the situation, and I asked if all cops were bad and all cops were racist. And I said, no. And then I asked them, I was like, do you guys think hate is taught or you're born to hate? And they pause for a second. And then one of them says, "You're taught to hate, right?" I'm like, "Absolutely." And then the other one, spur of the moment, I have a 2-year-old now, their little brother, and they're like, "Well, you know, we're going to have to teach Ashton how to love." And that kind of really hit me in the heart, because that's how simple this is, D. Like, all this hate and negative thoughts towards people based off the color of skin is a taught trait, you know? So it's unfortunate that 12-year-olds can see it and a majority of the world can't. So, you know, like you said, it's a conversation we have to have. And, you know, you just kind of have to prepare yourself, because, you know, like you said, my kids are 12. I'm not sure how old your son is now, but they're going to be teenagers soon. And, you know, they really have to just kind of be prepared for this, what this world is going to bring to them.
Right, right. So let's go back to Sacramento, and after Stephon Clark. So you organized a march, the March for Action at Cesar Chavez Plaza in Sacramento. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, I just like I said, try to use my platform, contact the people out there. You know, I have aspirations of running for mayor for out there one day. So I've been doing a lot of stuff in the community out there and just try to, you know, try to bring more awareness to the situation, you know, hoping that, you know, our actions and our marches would put some pressure on the DA to bring charges amongst these officers. Unfortunately, we failed. But like I said, it was kind of the beginning of, you know, well, actually wasn't the beginning. Let me take that back. It was just a string of, you know, ever since then, it's consistently been happening more and more often. And I think now more than ever, people are, you know, woke to it, speaking on it, but there's still no repercussions. I read an interesting article that they say 1% of officers are, what was it? I'm forgetting now. 1% are charged, or charged is the word. 1% are held accountable, and then like less than 1% are actually charged for, you know, killings. And it was just like, you know, 9.5 out of 10 times these officers are getting off of these crimes, and people want to talk about defund the police. And, you know, I agree. I don't agree with the wording right there, but to the bigger picture to me is the police union. You know, the two strongest unions that are out here are the police union and the teachers union. And they're very strong and very backed and funded well. So I think it starts, you know, with the reconstruction of the police union, because that is the true blue shield. And then I think the rest will trickle down. But like I said, it's a tough situation, but I'm glad, you know, I'm just one of many athletes or celebrities that are really trying to utilize our platforms. And I think we're starting to see the benefit of that. You know, we came out in record numbers this year to the polls to vote, to get Trump out. You know, we encouraged those great people in Georgia to get out and vote in that Senate race. And you know, we flipped the state. So I think now that people understand, I've always tried to tell people once I started getting in this lane that we're not the minority. They label us the minority to try to keep us in our place. But if we came together, we're actually the majority. And I think we're starting to understand that now, and the power that we have when we come together and flex our power at the polls.
So you have aspirations. You mentioned it to run for mayor. I didn't know that. Talk to me about that. And when did that start?
You know, Kevin Johnson, former NBA player from my hometown, did it. And when I first saw it, it wasn't so much about the political and so much of the policy side. I just really saw him making a difference in the community, out in the community, cleaning up the community, bringing opportunities to the community. And it really kind of struck me, like, you know, like I said, I had never even thought about politics before that, but I was just like, man, it would be cool if I can come back and, you know, kind of pick up where he left off, you know, eventually when I was ready. So that's what kind of sparked my interest. Obviously, there's a new mayor now, and Daryl Steinberg, and I'm working on a few projects in Sacramento to continue to improve my hometown. You know, I was lucky to be able to make it out. You know, you were lucky to be able to make it out. You know, one wrong move either way, and people probably could have never heard of us, and we could have been on the wrong end of the statistical category. So when I speak and the stuff I do is not necessarily for me, it's just for all the people that don't have a voice, that I remember where, you know, I remember where I came from. Like, my aunt was killed in the same city that Stephon Clark was killed. Her throat was slashed and she was left in the gutter. You know what I mean? So like, it directly affects me, and that's why I'm so outspoken on situations. But like I said, initially it was just to do better, but now kind of understanding the political side of it and learning the political side daily, it's something I definitely want to push for once my kids get a little older and, you know, all my business affairs are kind of settled.
That's great. That's great. Well, definitely my success to you with that. And you started a scholarship to make sure that Stephon Clark's sons would be able to go to college, right? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so it, to be honest with you, it didn't get as big because something else that came up at the time. But, you know, I have money aside for them when it's time. You know, I actually lost contact with the family. I keep in contact, you know, I get contact, her father, his girl's father. We go back and forth, but I haven't actually spoke to any of them in a while. You know, always, you know, always praying for the family, but you know, when those kids are ready, I'll definitely have money for them to make sure that they're taken care of, when it comes time for college.
That's great. Now, what kind of support did you get from the NBA community with the march, with everything? You know, what kind of support did they give you?
You know, Sacramento is always, you know, the Kings are always really good about, you know, community activities. I had a you know, some former teammates, you know, they played for Sac at the time that came out and supported. So I got some good support from the Kings. You know, my whole situation, like, I didn't really necessarily take it to the, you know, the NBA or the NBA's Players Association, because that wasn't why I was doing it at the time. Obviously, looking back, you know, you kind of want to connect as many dots as possible. But, you know, I was really just kind of, you know, it was a call to action. You know, this is my hometown. I'm one of the more, you know, notable names from that hometown. So I wanted to just try to do anything I could, like I said, to help ease the process for a grieving family.
Did you connect with any of the activists in the area? That's always interesting, because that's always interesting dynamic when athletes or, you know, entertainers or rappers or anything like that. Sometimes there's a little bit of either friction or there's opening with open arms from activists. I saw you with Jamila Land, I think. Mm-hmm. She's I've done some stuff with her. And I saw you, Reverend Sharpton, I think, at the funeral. But what are some of the activists that you connected with?
The two you mentioned. But like I said, that wasn't my plan, you know, to be honest with you. I wasn't looking for a handout or anything. Like I said, I just kind of really felt like Sacramento, being the small town that it is, it needed a big voice to bring attention to this situation. You know, like I said, so when I jumped to the forefront, DeMarcus Cousins jumped to the forefront. I think, like I said, it brought attention to it. Of course, you know, Al Sharpton does what he can do, always trying to shine light on situations like this. So from a friction standpoint, there was really no friction. Obviously, there's, you know, stuff you have to deal with when you're dealing with several family members and everyone expresses grief in a different way, you know what I mean? So we had a hard time dealing with his brother for a little bit. But like I said, who are we to tell someone how to grieve from from losing a family member? So, you know, obviously there were some small hurdles that we were fortunate enough to overcome. But like I said, my whole goal was just to bring attention to this situation that you always hear about around the country, and obviously you feel for it, but it's a special feeling in a bad way when it's your hometown.
Do you still get the comments or the criticism from some aspects of mainstream America that as athletes, they don't feel that we have, like, we're not regular Black people? Like, you know what I mean? Black and brown people, like, we don't feel the same, you know, sting of racism or anything like that, that the rest of the country. Do you get that? Because I get that sometimes. Yeah.
Daily.
And I'm like,
daily.
I'm like, are y'all serious?
Yeah. I mean, people think because we make money, that changes this color of our skin. And it doesn't, you know, that's how you live behind gates and you have X amount of money. Like, you don't feel this pain. And like I mentioned earlier in this interview, you know, when I speak up, it's for the voiceless. It's for the people that don't have the money. It's for the people that don't live behind the gates. It's for the people that don't have the platform that we have, letting people know that, you know, we never really forget where we come from. You know, some people get disconnected and that's unfortunate, but there's a lot of us that don't get disconnected. And just because we were able to make it out, you know, that took a lot of luck, hard work and love and prayers, obviously, we never forget where we come from, and we realize that we were one of the lucky ones that made it, because, you know, 9.5 out of 10 people aren't going to make it.
Right, right, right. You know, and going back to the discussion with your sons, like me, I just watched with my son Malcolm and my daughter Imani When They See Us, about the Central Park Five. Mm-hmm. And it was tough. You know, it was a tough, I don't know, have you seen it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so it was a tough watch, but you know, I wanted them to see it, and they asked so many different questions. And, you know, people don't understand what our young people are up against. And once they look at the justice system and the way they were treated in particular, you know, we had to take breaks and pauses, like, man. Oh my gosh, like, this is like, how did you react watching that?
You hit it on the head. I, you know, to be honest with you, E, it took me a lot longer to watch that series than it would take. I'm a binge watcher. That's one of my favorite things to do. I create content now, so I'm always watching for new ideas and stuff. But I had to take a few different breaks from that series, because it was so frustrating. Like, you wanted to cry, you wanted to hurt, you wanted to hurt somebody. You felt so bad for these kids at the time, because you can completely see how the system had screwed them and how people like Trump try to double down on it. And it was just a really unfortunate situation, but that's just one of many that, you know, Ava DuVernay did a great job of bringing that story to light. But how many Central Park Five situations are there across the country, or individuals or two people that have been screwed over by the justice system? So I think stuff like that is very important, although it's very hard to watch. these stories need to be told, because there is such a double-edged sword when it comes to policing and your ethnicity. And I think a perfect example was, you know, the raid at the Capitol on the 6th. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear several people saying, you know, what happened if they're Black? And I think we all know the answers to that. And, you know, now we're starting to see people get arrested and then bailed the same day, the next day, because right. they have the money to be able to do it. But if, you know, if the ethnic roles were reversed, these people would be all arrested, sitting there waiting for trial, convicted to the highest, you know, form of conviction possible. And I'm not setting myself up for, I wouldn't say heartbreak, but I kind of just have a feeling that, you know, outside of the policing system being crooked, the justice system is crooked as well, you know. So I'm not, you know, I don't have my fingers crossed thinking that all these people, you know, I'm not sure what the law was, but right before this happened, you know, Trump, what is it, a minimum of 10 for defacing property, you know what I mean? So, you know, I'm not, you hope, you know, because that's what they said. And if it was us, it would be a minimum of 10, but I'm not holding my breath for that to happen. I would love to see these people held accountable. But you just never know with the way society goes today.
And it's that double standard that's frustrating. And you know, you going back to the Central Park Five, you know, you see in the movie where they were kids, like they were like babies, you know, and they were treating them like they were hardened criminals. Right. And you know, it's just the way that they coerced their confession, kept them there. But that's real. Like that happens all the time.
Well, I mean, look at the Khalif Browder situation. You know, obviously Jay-Z did a great job of bringing that story to life. But this this young kid was treated like a grown man for a backpack that he didn't even steal, you know, was beat constantly by guards and inmates and like treated like a real man. And that really, he had a psychological breakdown, and you know what happened. And obviously rest in peace for him. But like I said, there's so many of these stories out there that happen to Black and brown people. It's unfortunate.
Right. Right. So what's the message when you talk to, you know, young Black men, young brown men, you know, it's hard. When I was playing with the Wizards, I worked with this great organization. It's called Free Minds, and it was in the correctional facilities in D.C. And I wasn't necessarily a youth, you know, it was in the same jail as the regular D.C. prison. It was just kind of like the youth section. You know what I mean? So it wasn't juvie, because they were in the regular D.C. prison. And my first thing was like, why are they here next to like the big prisoners? You know what I mean? These cats are like 13 and 14 years old. Right. And I'm listening to what they're in there for. And they're all little stuff, like little possession of a teaspoon of marijuana or a little bit of, you know what I mean? Some little stuff. And I'm going back to this and I'm seeing, and it's like the racial dynamics when they're different, you don't see the same. You get a totally different type of justice, punishment, everything.
Right.
No. That's the part that's so hard to, you know what I mean, wrap your mind around, because you see it happening to our young people so much.
Yeah. And I think it's a situation where we can't, obviously, I feel like, you know, with this new administration, we're definitely heading in the right direction. And I think it's all of our jobs to hold them accountable. But at the same time, depending on the system for justice is the wrong, I think, hope for Black and brown people, you know. So I work with a group called Advanced Peace, and we try to get it at the root. You know, we directly work with the actual shooters or people who are most likely to be shot, understanding that we continue to tell, you know, our underfunded communities, particularly Black and brown, you know, stop the violence, put down the guns. But what are we tooling them with? You know, for the most part, you know, that's their only means to survival. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying I agree with it, but, you know, you got to survive by any means. So, you know, with this group, Active Peace, we put them in an 18-month program. We set goals for the first 9 months. We communicate a lot with them. And in the second 9 months, you're able to actually earn money monthly for reaching your goal that you set. Okay. You know, so I think, you know, we need to do more at the root. Obviously, you see a bunch of companies now with this unfortunate situation with George Floyd, you know, they want to donate money. But I think often you need to work with the people on the ground and, you know, the liaisons of those cities, because what I need in my hometown is different from what you need in your hometown. And I think sometimes the umbrella of let's just throw some money at Black Lives Matter, or let's throw some money at, you know, at this and that, instead of actually working with the people in the community. Like, what do you need in Oakland? What do you need in DC? What do you need in Baltimore? Because all of us have, all these communities have an underlying problem, but for the most part, it's different, you know, where we feel like the money can really go. So I just think it's important to really try to align with people who know the city well, because like I said, you can't throw a blanket over this issue. You know, each city is different. Like I said, I just think, like I said, to kind of get to the root, to really start getting some funding in these communities, you know, which I thought was big for the NBAs to push the, you know, the owners to do. But we really got to start, you know, it's got to be less lip service and actually more, you know, putting the money where your mouth is and really getting in these communities and trying to help.
One of the things that I saw you meeting with President Biden before the elections. And you brought up his authoring of the crime bill. You brought up mass incarceration that, you know, was consequently from the crime bill. And, you know, you challenged him on it and you said you wanted to talk to him about it. And he was open to talk about it. Right. Tell me about that process, because it's an interesting dynamic, because at first it was like he wasn't going to address it, but then he finally addressed it. You know, it was kind of like the elephant in the room at first.
Well, he needed to. You know, he wanted, you know, at the end of the day, our vote is what got him through. I don't care what nobody says, you know, and for him to push for our vote, that was the first thing that came up. You know, when I'm trying to encourage people who've never registered to vote, thought about voting, thought that their vote mattered, understanding the importance of this election, well, Trump's bad, but, you know, what about the 94 crime bill? And, you know, I really didn't have a real rebuttal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when I go and ask these questions, it's tough questions, but at the same time, they're questions that need to be asked. But me kind of obviously doing a little more digging to the situation, just kind of understanding the, you know, the rate of violent crimes had been on the rise since the 60s. And then, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, what does the government do? They bring cocaine and guns to the hood. You know what I mean? So, you know, our families and people are, you know, drug addicts and committing crimes. So, you know, it was a perfect storm, you know, in 94 that some kind of foundation need to be laid to kind of restore order, you know, with it passed unanimously. But, you know, what I liked was, you know, after all these years, and, you know, whether he's telling the truth or not, he did have regrets on certain parts of the bill. And it seemed sincere on righting those wrongs. And, you know, the one thing he told me is, you know, the 2021, which we're in now, crime bill is going to try to, you know, fix the wrongs that were done from the 94 crime bill. You know, so we can only hope to see now, obviously, politicians know how to talk. And that's the way they get themselves elected. So, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to have a direct line to him now. And, you know, I have a group of, you know, people like myself, Deion Taylor, Robert Smith, the Black billionaire, Van Jones, Charlemagne, you know, we talk twice a month, you know, and that's just a few of us, but there's probably 50 people on the call. And, you know, we want to be able to hold this president accountable, understanding that we understand how powerful our vote is now. So although we put him in office, we understand that if him and, you know, Vice President Harris don't live up to what they promised or said and do, that we have the power to push them aside and get someone else new in now. So I really think these two, you know, the president and the vice president now are not necessarily go out of their way, but I think it's definitely on their minds, because neither of their track records were good for people that look like us leading to this situation. But people that look like us are the people who put them in office, you know. Mm-hmm. So I feel fairly confident that they are going to, like I said, try to right some of their wrongs and really step out on an edge. And you see, you know, Biden's cabinet now is the most diverse cabinet, you know, we've had. And I'm just kind of excited to see what happens, you know, once we can get past all this Trump BS and hopefully get him out the picture for good. You know, once they, if they're finally able to charge him with this impeachment, you know, allowing him never to run again. Right. I think, you know, we're headed in the right direction. Now, are Harris and Biden the answer? We're going to have to wait and see. But like I said, if hopefully they are, and we can start going that right direction and get them two terms and hand it off to the next group of people. But if they're not, you know, it's our jobs to get them out.
I mean, it's interesting you talk about that, though, because I had my reservations and my objections to different parts of Biden's past and Kamala Harris's past.
Right.
But then I was looking at the alternative. And you know, so you're looking at the alternative. And right. Even going back to when they see us, you know, he was pushing for these teenagers to be executed. Like, literally, like, that's what he wanted to happen. Like, he wanted to have them lynched in the middle of the town, like back in slavery times, because they were accused of raping a white woman. And that's it. No, it didn't matter the evidence. They didn't have any DNA. They played. And that's the part that hurt me so much. The prosecutor, Linda Fairstein. Like, I remember how hard, like in the movie, the way it was depicted, and she kept calling them animals, and it doesn't even matter. They had to do it. And like that. That depiction was so much of an accurate representation of what happens typically in the justice system with our young black and brown kids. So it's like, you know, that has to be addressed, because that can't continue, you know, going to a new president and having a new wave and everything like that. That can't, the same thing can't continue.
No, it's unfortunate, you know what I mean? But if you think about it, what most people don't know is, you know, how did policing start? Policing were started as slave wranglers, you know what I mean? So anything that was built on a foundation based off prejudice and hate, and it was bound to eventually rear its head. But like I said, it's not just the policing system. It's the DA, it's the judges. Like, it really runs deep. And it's unfortunate because, like I said, there's statistics on this, but people still don't want to. They want to overlook the statistics when it comes to a negative portrayal of a system. But then when they look at our statistics of us being incarcerated and us being in gangs and us doing this and that, oh, those statistics are right. But, you know, when you pull up these statistics on, you know, our system, it's overlooked for some reason. So it's not going to be an easy fix. We have to understand it took over 400 years to get here. I think we're finally at the tipping point. I can comfortably say we're finally at the tipping point. And now we have to see what's going to happen from here on out.
But it's important that you're pushing and holding him accountable. And that's like, because sometimes, you know, we were under such a dark cloud with Trump. And then so it's like the bar is set so low that anything looks better, right?
Right.
So, but still, even though we're going to have, you know, a new regime, we have to hold this regime accountable.
Absolutely.
And we can't be partying so much and just, okay, everything is great now, so we don't have to worry. Then that's not what you're. So that's why when I saw you doing that and meeting with him and forming that coalition of all these different people, I was just like, you know, applause. Like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I appreciate that thing. And I think also what we have to understand, and like I said before, like, although we're here to hold them accountable, and the one thing I'll say is Biden's doors are open. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have to understand it's not going to happen overnight. You know, this is going to be. It took us so long to get here that. You know, we have the Senate now, and so things, hopefully, you know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Bill will get passed now. So, like I said, it's going to be a process of changing something. But, you know, this is a critical time in our country, because I think what you're seeing now, and I say this with all due respect, is, you know, white men are fearing their power slip away. You know what I mean? And I think that's why you're seeing all this rebel and you're seeing all this crazy Trumpness, is because the to me, in my eyes, hopefully the playing field is going to start leveling off, because look what all we've accomplished as black people, but brown people as well. And we've always been behind the eight ball. They've done everything they possibly can to keep us in our place. And we're still, that's why I think people like Jay-Z are so important. Robert Smith, Puffy, we have to see it to imagine. Like, we have black billionaires out there. Like, it can be done. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, like I said, if they give us equal footing, I think that's what they really fear, is we're gonna excel and really kind of take our rightful place on, you know, at least equality. You know, it's not like I say we want it all back. We want you to pay for what you did. We just want equality. We want to be treated just like our counterparts that are a different color than us. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to see people gunned down by the police on the 6th, but I don't want to see black people gunned down for sleeping, for jogging, for all right. For holding toy guns. You know what I mean? Like, we just want the same opportunity that you're giving other people.
Right, right. You know who I would like to see join your coalition is Ice Cube, to be honest with you. I don't know. How did you interpret that whole situation? I understood where his heart was. I had a few questions, you know what I mean, of the implementation, but I understood what's going on. How did you interpret this?
I haven't got a chance to talk to Cube because actually during that time, he was supposed to come on our show and stuff got really hot. So, it kind of took a back seat for a minute. But from what I understand from looking on the outside, looking in, was he presented an opportunity to both sides. And it seemed like the only side that at the time, from what I saw, that was willing to have a conversation with them was Trump's side. You know, so do you work with someone to try to, for the betterment of our people, someone as bad as Trump? Like I said, you're going to have people on both sides of the fence. But from my understanding was, you know, he didn't get any kind of response from the Biden campaign. So he went with the Trump campaign. So, you know, knowing Cube and knowing if you're a fan of his music and a fan of him, he's been on this since he's come on the platform. You know what I mean? Since Straight Outta Compton, he's always been politically outspoken, and it's always been for us. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I think this is a situation where, you know, his heart was in the right place. Maybe mm-hmm. his words got twisted, or the situation got twisted, or maybe he was trying to help and they made it seem like he was really working for Trump or with Trump. Mm-hmm. So, you know, until I get a chance to sit down and talk to him, which I know I will, I really don't want to pass judgment, but his track record to me has proven that he's always been for us.
Well, I would love to see him come on All the Smoke and just clear everything up, break everything down. So I'm looking forward to seeing him come on there, because, you know, we grew up listening to Cube.
Huge Cube. I mean, straight, like, we are Cube fans, and you know, for me to get a chance to, you know, someone I idolize, and some I get a chance to know this dude, his greatness is right in front of me, you know. And he came one time, and when I retired, and pitched me on the Big Three and came to my house, and you know, we got, you know, new teams, they'll give you, you know, so to be able to be a fan of his track record and what he's been able to do with the Big Three, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt until, like I said, I get an opportunity to hopefully talk to him, or I see him talk about this with someone else and really tell his side of the story.
Right. I definitely agree. Now, let me ask you this, you know, because there's a lot, I saw a few examples of some of the traditional media outlets that get very upset with people like you and Stack, and you know what I mean, because you all are getting what I see is getting the interviews that they can't get, going with, you know, people who they haven't even been able to crack the surface with, and they've been trying for 25 years, you know. But that level of hatred that you're getting from the mainstream media, I mean, for me, it just says that you're doing something right.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? That's what it just shows. But what is your reaction to some of the hatred that you get?
I just smile, you know what I mean? Because it was similar hatred I got when I played, and you know that, you know, you can never, you're never going to be able to make everybody happy. But I think, you know, my whole goal with All the Smoke was to be able to humanize our guest. And, you know, you know, rest in peace, Kobe's greatness. You know, KG, Steph, KD, you know what all these guys are great for. But I wanted to be able to strip that down and show how that process came about, what turns they made, or, you know, what obstacles they overcame to become as great as they are at their craft. And I think because of myself and Jack's track record, obviously a spotted track record to say the least, but it's always been real. You know what I mean? We've got into some trouble. We've owned up to it. If we needed to apologize, we've apologized. You know, if we were on, you know, we've always handled ourselves, I think, in the realest type way. So I think when we get our guests, they understand that, you know, we're not here for clickbait. We're not here to start trouble. We really just want to be able to have an in-depth conversation. And like I said, it was never a situation where I wanted to put a mic in someone's face. I don't want that kind of interview. I want to be a kickback atmosphere, like we're at the house, you know, medicating or having a drink and just having a good conversation. And I think that's what we've been able to do, is because of the realness Jack and I have always approached life with, and with the game with, the people respect that. So they feel like they can come and be comfortable with us. And we have, you know, there's I forgot the guy's name, Phil something from the New York Post, that just wrote a horrible article about me and Jack, like horrible.
I saw that.
I'm just like, you know, you're mad because you've been in this space for 30 plus years. At the time, we hadn't even done All the Smoke for a year, but our resume far exceeded, you know, anything he's ever done. You know what I mean? Right. But to me, how I used to use that for fuel as a player, I use that for fuel in the media now. You know what I mean? And it's crazy, you know, that we call ourselves media now, because I never thought media, you know what I mean? I like to say that, you know, seeing people like me, you, and the knuckleheads, and all these other people that are former players in this space, we've always allowed other people to tell our stories. Right. We've always just been the talent. You know what I mean? You go score touchdowns or dunk, shoot threes, hit home runs, you know, run world records in track, and let let these white people tell our stories. But we're intelligent enough now and can hold the conversation long enough and paint a picture well enough now to tell our own story. And I think, again, that's a little bit of that power slippage that they're starting to see from mainstream media, that what are these athletes doing coming in here and doing our jobs and for in some cases doing, you know, our job better.
A lot better. A lot better. So one more question for you. I'm a part of this Facebook group called Black Fathers, and there is a big group. It's funny because it started off kind of small. I just had my first son. You know, he's 15 now, so it was a long time ago. Now it's up to thousands and thousands of people in the group, right? So we have all these different conversations in there. Guys sometimes ask for help about stuff, encouragement. Sometimes they just want to brag on their kids. Guys going through the court system, whatever. You know what I mean? It's like a serious group, you know, of brothers that are really, you know, vibing off of each other, right? So they had a big discussion, and they were talking about you and how you were able to be the bigger man for the sake of the children. I think it was a post that you, it was like for Christmas or something like
that. It was for the twins' birthday party.
There we go, the twins' birthday party. And there was a big picture with you and, you know, Derek Fisher was there and everybody. Mm-hmm. So they just wanted me to ask, how did you do that? How did you put everything aside, and how did you do that?
Yeah. That's the question. You guys said it's for the betterment of the kids. Obviously, when the situation had went down, you know, what people say is, you know, he stole your wife, this and that. So my ex-wife and I, Gloria, at the time were divorced. And she happened to move on with him. And, you know, now that I'm on good terms with both of them, you know, the initial conversation was, you know, you can't help the way I approached it was, you can't help who you fall in love with. But at the same time, there's ways to handle situations, you know, like this, respectfully. The fact that we were teammates for a few years, we were good friends, you know, we hung out. You know, if a situation like that arises, like I said, you can't help who you fall for. But at the same time, there's a way to handle it. You could have came to me as a man. She could have came to me as an ex. Mm-hmm. But to allow my kids be the one to break the ice to me, what really kind of bothered me. So, you know, we had our altercation, but, you know, they had found love, and who was I to get in the way with that? You know, like I said, my ex and I were done. So it just came to a situation where he was always at their games, and it was just kind of an awkward, and I coach my kids. Ever since I retired, I coached them at football and basketball, so they're always going to see me there. Right. And he would come with Glory, and it was just awkward because he would kind of stand away from everyone when I was there or trail pack when everyone is leaving. And I'm just like, I don't want this awkwardness. And at the same time, my kids really liked him. You know, Dad, we love Derek. He's great. He's this, this, and that. That's my first concern. So the fact that, you know, her and I were out of love, and we were both going in our separate directions, and she was, you know, in a relationship with him, I'm just like, well, let me just holler at this dude and kind of give him my point of view. And just like I told you, you know, I just didn't like the way you handled the situation. If you would have came to me like a man, I wouldn't have liked it, but I would have respected it. You know what I mean? I had to respect it. And like I said, my only priority in this situation now is my kid's happiness, and there's happiness there. So it took us, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years to get there. You know, but now, you know, they're happily, you know, in their situation. I have a situation with my youngest son's mom, you know, so we've all moved on and for the betterment of the twins, because when my ex-wife and I were going through things, I could see it on the boys. And that was the last thing, you know. They were 5 when we started, you know, separating and kind of going through the divorce, and, you know, they're 12 now. So it was just a tough situation to kind of see them have to bear the weight of their parents' issues. So I wanted to try to do, you know, once I was in a good space and, you know, ready to move forward, I wanted to relieve any kind of stress from their minds, because, you know, being kids is already stressful enough. I didn't want them to have to deal with anything that was adult cause. So, like I said, squash the beef. We're in a great place now. You know, we spent their birthday together. You know, oddly enough, I had a situation at my house obviously COVID safe, but you know, I have my current girl, I have my ex-wife, and I had my former teammate. You know what I mean? So it's just, but like I said, it was for the twins' birthday. Everyone had a good time. People were drinking. All the adults were outside playing laser tag. So it was just like a good, solid environment because, you know, at the end of the day, we're week on, week off. So he's the man in their life for 2 weeks out of the month. You know, for half a year, he's the man they're going to see. You know what I mean? So I just hit him with, you know, we got to do a good job of raising these boys, you know, like we're on the same team again, you know what I mean? So our goal is to raise two young biracial, but African-American boys in this country. And, you know, outside of the move he's pulled, Fish has always been a cool dude to me. You know what I mean? So once we got past, you know, the situation, I think we were able to, you know, shake hands like men and understand it's not about us no more. It's about the kids.
Wow. That shows a lot of maturity. You know what I mean? I got to be honest with you. It does. Hey, so.
It took a minute. It took a minute because, and like I said, that's one of the things that I think has been able to help me be successful in this space because I never looked at myself as an NBA player. Like I'm a man first. So if disrespectful stuff happens to me, I'm going to act accordingly. You know, if you think about it, like people have been killed for shit much less than that. You know what I mean? Like stuff, you know, stepping on those kind of toes, like in real life, real stuff goes down. So I didn't look at myself as, oh man, damn, he did that to me, but I play in the NBA. So I'm just, and I'm like, nah, like you disrespected me as a man. So, you know, we went about what we feel like we needed to do to get the situation handled. But like I said, I think that, you know, that was obviously a knock or, you know, I was criticized by some, but then applauded by some. But like I said, I think I handled it the best way I could at the time. And the fact that we're on talking terms and really co-parenting terms now, it all ended up for the good, but it was tough. Trust me, it was tough. Like I said,
Just know in the Facebook group I'm in with black fathers with thousands of people, nobody criticized your initial reaction. I just want to let you know that. Everybody was in your corner and understood exactly how you responded.
Well, I appreciate it.
Let me say, you know, like I said, much respect to you and everything that you and Stack are doing. Keep doing it. You know what I mean? I love to keep supporting you, especially with the stuff that you're doing with keeping Biden accountable. So I would, you know, if you need any help with that or be a part of something or, you know, recruit different people, because that's something that is really important moving forward, because we have to hold him accountable. Like I said, it can't be just a party and everybody happy because Trump is gone. And then it can't be that. We got to keep him and keep the heat on him.
Oh, and once we get done, send me your email. You know, next time we have, we're always looking for like-minded people with the platform who have a voice and understand the greater good of the group, you know. So I'll plug you in the next time we have. You know, we just had a call with the Surgeon General a week and a half ago asking, you know, because they want us to start telling people to take these vaccines. And we're like, hell no. Like, explain to us what, you know what I mean? So, like, we're having these real conversations with people who are in charge now, you know what I mean? So I'd love to bring you in the group. I've been a fan of, obviously, ever since we beat you when you guys came to UCLA when you were at Syracuse.
But
the way you were able to carry yourself throughout your career, always, you know, the cosmic professional, and then what you've been able to do, obviously, post-basketball and in your books and writing and, you know, just showing that you care, you know what I mean? So I've always been a fan of that, and I'll salute you for that. So I would love to, you know, bring you in the fold and shit, help us out.
That's what's up. I really appreciate that, man. And, you know, definitely mutual respect. So I'm going to take you up on that, man, and keep doing what you're doing, man. And thanks for coming on the rematch. Thanks for being a part of my book. And like I said, stay safe and keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely, bro.
Thank you for listening to The Rematch. You can find more episodes on basketballnews.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review. You can also find my articles on basketballnews.com, along with exclusive content from Kenyon Martin, Vinny Del Negro, James Posey, and more. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at AtonThomas36. Let me know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see as a guest. I would love your feedback.